Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of those of us who have arranged this, I want to most sincerely apologize to you for this confusion. Hundreds of people are being turned away now. It did not seem wise to sell tickets when Mr. Adamski was not yet in the country and it was not quite certain that he would be able to give this lecture. But the public interest has been far greater than any of us thought. And the result has been we've tried very hard to ensure that those who did write in got seats. And if there are some who aren't still in the queue and have not got in, I have no means of apologizing to them, but we did not book more than we had. Now, Mr. Adamski will be introduced to you by Mr. Desmond Leslie, who wrote the first part of the book Flying Saucers Have Landed. Mr. Adamski will then talk to you for about an hour, and then he will show a film of actual saucers lasting about 20 minutes. And after that, he will answer written questions. The audience will have an opportunity to write the questions after the lecture and before the film. And the commissioners will bring them up to the chair. Mr. Desmond Leslie.
Ladies and gentlemen, give me tremendous pleasure tonight to introduce to you who I think is really one of the most certainly memorable people we will ever meet in our generation. It's not every day you run into somebody who is accustomed to hobnob with spacemen and to make friends with them as Mr. Adamski has done. I'm perhaps in a rather privileged position, as I have known Mr. Adamski since 1954, and I have lived with him in California, when I can tell you now, we did see flying saucers on several occasions, once as near as that projector is from me, and only very recently I was with him when we had the privilege of meeting a spaceman. I'm not going to talk very long. My function really is a sort of stooge in between the chairman and the speaker. It's a sort of keep things going while the last people did settle down and sort of kick the neighbors and roll their coats up, generally enjoy themselves. I have never seen Mr. Adamski looking so well or such full of beans, even though he has been more than halfway around the world. I think he's got 60 or 70 lectures on this world program. He's going to tell you a great deal of things not in the books you've read, and we do hope too the questions you'll ask will be those that will bring out more things that you want to know. You're also going to see, which I may tell you, is a very remarkable film with some extraordinary shots in it. I've seen over it this afternoon on a static projector analyzing some of them. They're quite the best movies I've seen of flying saucers. Well, everyone seems fairly happy, fairly quiet, so let's get me out of the way and hand you over to George Adamski.
Thank you, my friends. I'm very glad to be here after disappointing a lot of you 3 years back when I couldn't make it when everything was really set up. I have much to say in reference to what have transpired in the last 11 years, but I'll let that go toward the last. I will begin at the moment with my experience, which I believe you are more interested than what has transpired in the governments themselves. First place, I would like everybody else, being brought up in a way as sort of an astronomer, by taking up astronomy in 1929, naturally we were taught that there was no one in our system on any of the other planets but ourselves. Naturally, when they appeared on the scene, it was hard to accept after you've been taught that way. Yet many, many times I have questioned whether the information given during the astronomical studies were really correct. I've been quite inquisitive ever since I was born, I might say. Try to question everything, quite critical of some of them. So in this case, it was no exception. So finally, in 1946, in October, when all of us that were amateur astronomers were informed to count the meteorites that had fell during that month, I think it was on the 19th, count them as near as we could, as how many were falling per minute. The moon actually was shining bright, so some of the small ones could not be counted or seen. But during that time, quite a large number of us, and Desmond had been on that property, overlooking towards San Diego, which is a few mountains ahead of us there, known as Rodriguez Mountain, Belcan Mountain, while the Palomar is in the background of us. We saw this big ship appear, and it was something like a dirigible size, but it didn't have a basket on it, which was strange. This basket was missing, as is customary with them, but we thought then, well, during the war, they might have developed something we never heard nothing about. So we let it go at that. But suddenly the thing shot out into outer space, straight up, awfully fast, and left the amber trail behind it. Well, we questioned that a little bit in reference to the amber trail. Still didn't think nothing of it. After it's gone out of sight, we no longer could count any meteorites. We went to this cafe, which Miss Wells run it. I never owned a business of any kind. I didn't own this cafe. I lived on the property and been seen in the cafe lots of time talking to people. So we went to this cafe, and of course, the KFSB, San Diego Station, was broadcasting the news of the meteorites and other things. And they mentioned this particular ship. They said it was a spacecraft that passed over San Diego, a big one, which was mothership type, that we've been told since, and that they didn't know why it did not land, so they consulted a medium down there in San Diego to follow the ship up mentally. I'm giving it to you as it was given then. And she was supposed to have gone out to contact them mentally and come back stating that they did not land because they did not know how they would be received. That was the reason. And that's all there was to it. Well, a few Sundays after that, finally, people coming up to this cafe, there was pro and con, knowing that I was interested in astronomy and also been lecturing on it right there to people that come from the top, 200-inch observatory. So we had an argument going on, pro and con, among some people there that come up to the restaurant to eat. And I was saying at the time, it was fantastic, basing it at the time on the information received through astronomical teachings. When three officers were sitting a table next to the table I was talking to, and one of them was a captain, they were from Arizona. And finally, they couldn't stand it, I guess, so one of them spoke up, and he says, the smell is fantastic as it sounds. When you're nine feet away from one of these things, you really know what you're looking at. So then I turned my attention to them. I wanted no more. And we asked them, and they told us a few things, not too much. They couldn't talk too much about it, they said, but they did tell us and assured us that the spacecraft was coming. Well, then, of course, it was in 47, when the news broke wide open that Kendall Funnel over Mount Rainier in the state of Washington. Naturally, again, there was a lot of questioning pro and con from an astronomical angle and many of us. And so, again, I was wondering how much truth there was to this situation in general. And I kept on doing it. I didn't accept the thing immediately. I started looking into it. I closed my mind to it, but I never accepted it fully either. So in 49, when a military branch came up, and they were going up to the top, it was raining that day very heavily, and they was going up the top of what we called the Dubuque Observatory to ask them to photograph what was going on in space. That was the first instruction I understand given to the Dubuque Observatory to do that. Now, they can't do that very well with a 200-inch. But they could do it with the 18 and the 48 that's up there, as well as there's the 12. So those instruments would lend themselves for that purpose very well. So they stopped to eat at the place, and knowing that I had a 15 and a 6. So they asked me if I would also do the same. There was no money involved, no pay of any kind. It's voluntary work. I said, I would. But I says, what am I to photograph? Well, it's traveling through space. What is that? They wouldn't name it. I says, what is the target? Well, he said, the target is the moon. So the moon even went to a moon picture that I had, good size, about 4 foot, that I got from McDonald Observatory out of Texas. And they even marked the side that I should watch that portion of the moon. Sure enough, after a few tries, set up my equipment and all of that, and got 2 pictures. And according to the agreement made between him and myself, I kept quiet. I sent those pictures to the laboratory at Point Loma, where I was told to. And I got no answer one way or the other. Till one day, shortly after the pictures were sent, which was about 2 weeks, I was lecturing in El Cajon district of San Diego to what they call every man's club, every man's club. And the reporter come up there, that was an ace reporter in a World War number 2 in the Pacific. There was supposed to be no reporters there at the time. Well, he sat down and asked me some questions in reference to the things that were moving through space. Nothing was said in reference to the pictures I had taken already. So, naturally, I thought that was all right. So it was a journal that's out of existence now. So the journal published a very nice article about the lecture and so forth. And finally, somehow, the Union and the Tribune, that is in existence today, have gotten some information from some source in reference to the existing pictures. So they went to this laboratory and asked, and they denied it. So the denial kept on going. I have a whole stack of clippings, pro and con, going on, a battle between Washington and the Tribune and the Union. They come to me finally, and I was to be a sort of a scapegoat in this case, being in the military service, I have been from 1913 to 1919, I knew the procedure. So I knew what was going on that way. So since they let me down, I figured then finally I might as well open my mouth up, which I did. I claimed that they were in existence, and still denial kept coming. So finally, Copley Cable is known by that name, which is the Union and Tribune, shot over a message to Pentagon. 3 months prior to this, Pentagon have discontinued research on flying saucers. They made that public. Well, so nobody knew that they were any more interested in the flying saucers. Yet, the answer came to the paper saying that if there were such a pictures, they would have known about it. They know nothing about it, and they were a little skeptical in reference to those pictures, which proved again also that they were double-talking. 3 months prior to that, it made a statement they were no longer interested. Here they still tell us that they were interested in a picture like that would have been brought to them had it been in existence. But they were not sure of themselves. So they must have sent a wire to the laboratory, and the laboratory issued the letter. A fellow that's passed over since was the Los Angeles Times that wrote the science part for that paper, was present with a doctor when the letter came. And it read, as you probably remember, those of you that bought the flying saucer have landed, we published it there. It read that they thought it probably was electric discharge or static electricity on the film doing a process of rolling in cold or hot weather. The fact remains that I did not use rolled film. I had plates. So that knocked that out. Yet they did not ask me what sort of a film I used at the time taking these photographs. Well, the next thing, of course, they said in the next paragraph, as those of you who read the Flying Saucer Atlantic can read and see for yourself, that they didn't think it had anything to do with visitors. Well, if there is no visitors, why even mention? Yet they did. So Bill immediately pricked up his ears and said, give me that letter, and I'll take it to the Times and bust them wide open. I said, Bill, I've been in the service. I know what the program is, more or less, in that way. I said, just let it be quiet. It'll work out all right. I'd rather have it that way. So he said, okay, go on ahead. Then after they did that, of course, I got disgusted with them. See? And so I switched over to the Air Force, and I didn't do that immediately either. It was after Mr. Thompson of the RAND project, which is their air research project in Santa Monica, came up with his wife, and he wanted to see all the film I had. He examined it early, and then ordered me to send all the photographs of this film to Wright Field, Dayton, Ohio, where the research was going on. At that time, Captain Lupel, as he is now known, was but a lieutenant, but in charge of the research. So, I did that very thing. Then he told me, now, these films that you've got, the originals, I would like for you to lock them up. You can make copies of them from which you can make prints, but the originals, lock them up, which they are locked up. Not where I cannot get them at all, but they are locked up. So, immediately, things start moving. Well, I realized then that things were happening that we knew but little about. A lot of fancy ideas came along from all sources. Everybody seemed to know the answer. As of the date, we find the same thing. That overnight, experts sprung up on space and spacecraft. That even today, most of us that did most of the research were up to date, still don't know anything about them. And a way to become an expert in that field. Yet experts sprung up all over the world, suddenly. All kinds of messages began to trickle in from various sources, which was not the truth at all. Confused the issue terrifically. So, we finally find that in 1951, when Walter Winchell, over nationwide hookup, and he's a top reporter or a commentator in the States, made the statement point blank, saying that spacecraft was landing up in the desert, which is only about 30 miles from where we live, that it was seen landing there by the big observatory, men getting out of the ships, looking around, walking around, boarding into the ship again, and taking off. Then I thought, well, this is a good place to go and try to get some photographs. If that's what they're doing, I might get a close-up. The pictures you have seen in the books, as good as they are, due to the fact that a telescope, if you understand how that works, telescopes act similar to your flashbulb. You get always a good picture with a flashbulb, but you might not get as good a picture if you didn't use it. Well, the same is true with a telescope. The mirror acts as a flashbulb. They're backing up the object. And it's also magnification brings it down closer to you to photograph it. So naturally, I would take my 6-inch, as I could make it portable, and go out to the desert. Many times I went out there and nothing happened. But I've always considered it was a day spent, sort of a vacation, away from home, and I didn't really get discouraged. So one day, in the volunteer, when Williamson and Bailey's come up from Arizona, they heard of me, since that all that publicity went out in reference to the pictures that was denied and then finally admitted. So they come up and with a story. They thought they had a great story to tell. Well, I listened to them for a little bit, and that was in reference to the ticker in the Santa Fe station at Needles. And this ticker had, like all railroad stations have, to direct the trains and so forth, was supposed to make a contact over the ticker system with the space people. And they come and told me about it. Well, I've already had quite a bit of information in that relationship from other sources. So I told them what I knew, a little bit, not too much. And they figured I knew more than they did, so they didn't tell me much more after that. But instead they asked me, would you let us go out with you sometime when you go out to the desert? I said, that'd be all right. They seem to be nice people. So when you do, telephone us and reverse the charges, which I did. So we met them at Blight. And then after we had the breakfast, we figured, where are we going? I followed my hunches, where are we going? So I finally figured to go back to a road that was branching off the main highway, known as the Parker Highway, which goes to Parker Dam, also Indian Reservation. So It's a very beautiful highway and a wide one. So we went back, which was 40 miles from Blythe, backtracking, and turned there and went up about 10 miles or one-tenth or something of that nature. Not quite 10.5 miles. And it come up the hill and going down again. So we stopped right on the peak of it. So we could see both valleys, this one and the other one on the opposite side. Quite a large mountains here and here. On the right-hand side, going up that road, is an old abandoned airport used during the war. On the left-hand side going up is an old target range, pretty well battered down by the heavy machinery going through there and things like that. And there's quite a wash up there. It goes up into the mountain area with some hillsides on the left of it. So we stood upon this top, and the B-29 came through on his routine flight. Next thing we saw was this big mothership aircraft that has now been named Mothership, and we thought our eyes were deceiving us. And so we looked through binoculars, and we saw this ship having no wings or appendages of any kind, but it had a red sort of a symbol on the back of it, on the top, an orange looking. So immediately thought, well, this must be one of those ships. So I said to the group, I says, now, some of you stay and watch this, while some of us will go down. There was 7 of us, all together, including me. We'll go down and help me set up the telescope. But it was right near the wash, where I might photograph this ship, and that was the idea. At the time, putting the instruments together and placing the camera on it, and I had 8 plates fully filled with the film ready to go. We were so busy watching and putting up the instrument that we didn't watch what was happening in the sky. During that time, the mothership released one of these so-called flying saucers. And it came in, just like we've come into this room. Here we are, and here's the mountains going circling all around, just like that. And I shot all 8 shots at it. Didn't take too much time to focus. You didn't have the time. You were excited. You didn't know how long it's going to be there for you to photograph. You didn't know anything. So you'd done the best you could. I figured that most of those shots probably were no good at all, because the way I had to work. The group again stood a little ways from me. Not too far. It says a mile. That's not true. Less than 1/2 mile, some of them. Some even closer than that. Because Miss Wells sketched the man perfectly. All right? And she couldn't see that much, unless she was close enough to sketch him, as an artist must be. But I had them there standing, because the highway is heavily traffic sometimes, not always, but most of the time, and there were cars moving pretty heavy on it that day. And I figured, well, if I'll start gapping in the sky and set up a telescope right nearby, all these cars will be stopping, and the next thing, we won't have a chance to even photograph it. It might just vanish out of sight just that quick. So I took the precautions to handle it that way. But after I shot the 8 of them, she went over the hill, and that's the last I saw. I thought that was the end. I looked up into the sky. The big mothership was so small out there, must have been awfully high up there. She went out in outer space as far as from the earth she could, and yet you see a little bit. I didn't see the saucer really go up to it or nothing. I just saw it go over the hill and disappear. So I thought to myself, well, I wonder where it got to. So I called a group to help me dismantle the instrument when a man finally waved to me. As he waved to me, I thought then, well, this is nothing new either. In the California desert, people go out there prospecting either for gold or for precious stones. So I thought maybe one of these prospectors needed some help. I was cautious going up to them because they could be anything. I also knew that all of them here were watching me. I've already waited for them to come and help me dismantle the instrument. So I knew that if anything did happen to me, they would see it. And in that way, I could get help. And the same was true at the time I was taking the pictures, the same way. Well, the closer I got to it, the caution begins to relax. Not because I intended to, but it just merely happened. I realized this man had long hair, but that was nothing new either. Because in the California desert, when you get out there and stay a year or a year, you naturally have no barbers around here. You must let them grow, and they're going to really get long. So that was nothing strange. So I figured it could be one of our people. Well, when I got close to him, then I realized that something just dropped away from you, caution and all, and very mild sort of a feeling come over you, like it made you feel like you have known a man for all your lifetime, even before. He had that condition around him. He had this what appeared to be one-piece suit. Yet it wasn't. Later I have learned, because of two pieces and where the belt came in, that's where the two pieces joined. But you couldn't see it that way. So he had this belt which was between 6 and 8 inches width. And so he put out his hand to shake hands first. Well, I naturally grabbed a grip. He refused that. Then he put it out again. The way he put it out, that's the way I followed the instructions then. I got an impression to do that. Then he touched it and gave a certain signal, which to this day have not been revealed for purpose of identity, to identify the reading, because once it's given, it's no longer of any value. Anybody could fake one up then. But he gave me that, and immediately I realized this was something different. But I looked around and saw no ship, and I also knew that while the ship was in flight, and I was photographing it, that there was no one stepped out of it. So I was wondering where he came from. Then all of a sudden, while we're talking, of course, he stepped away from the pockets of sand. So there's a blowing wind blowing in there, blows sand in his pockets. And it's not the kind of sand that you think like on a beach or something like that. It's a sand that takes an imprint pretty good. And he was not heavier to make that imprint, because I left mine there too as I walked with him. And I wasn't putting on any extra weight on myself to do that. But he left those imprints, they were funny, and he pointed to them, meaning they meant something. I have been studying and teaching also telepathic communication, which is a thought transference, so I tried to convey my ideas to him, because I spoke first to him and he did not answer in a language of any kind. So then I figured this is what I must do, and that was gestures and talk pictures to him. At times I felt he was not getting it, most of the time I felt he did, but I was not sure I was getting his correctly. But when he pointed to those footprints and all, made me feel that there was something in them, there was a reason for him leaving him. He made three of them, like that. After he did that, wind was blowing pretty good, out in the desert, and must have moved that ship that was hiding, because a flash of light shot out into space, and I spotted it. So immediately I started looking where it came from. And then when I found where the ship was hovering in a cove, horseshoe-type cove, the hillside was like this, and the ship was anchored against it, while down he was suspended at the other end in a neighborhood of about, we say, 12 to 13 feet from the ground, against the hillside. So I then asked him, is that your ship? And he nodded his head, it was. So we walked over from here, about 75 to 100 feet, walked over from the spot we were standing at where we first met, over to the ship. He then warned me not to get too close to it. Well, when you get to talking and all excited and don't know what word to bring forth or what thought, because millions of them are passing through your mind in a time like that, you forget yourself. And I kept moving around just like you tread water, and before I knew, I was partially under the flange of the ship. And that's when my arm got caught, pulled up, and slammed back and paralyzed. Well, he grabbed for me then. Actually grabbed for me, because had he not done so, I would have fallen fully onto that ship, and my whole body would have got that condition instead of the arm alone. He grabbed for me, and the brush, of course, a lot of brush, wild brush growing in the desert. As he grabbed for me, he scratched his hand and bled very fiercely right here on the surface. Blood like yours and mine, not one bit different. He rubbed it three times finally, and it stopped bleeding, and he smiled, and he made it. Through his gestures and so forth, assured me that my arm will be all right, which has cleared up. Yet, here and there, about 2-3 times a year, sometimes oftener, my arm goes limp. I feel I got something there, but I can't move it. It doesn't stay that way for any length of time, for about a minute or two, and then pass away. But finally, I looked up into the ship where the dome part was, and I saw another person there. Just who it was, I have never got to know now. But there was another person in the ship. So he talked with me for a little bit, and that's the time I asked him where he was from. When I pointed to the sun, it was 1 o'clock at noon. And I made that swing with my hand, call it orbit number one. But after all, you must admit that we are the person in the ship. So he talked with me for a little bit, and that's the time I asked him where he was from. When I pointed to the sun, it was 1 o'clock at noon. And I made that swing with my hand, calling orbit number one, because after all, you must admit that we are the people who named those planets according to the ones who discovered them. That they would not have the same name for their planets that we give them. The only answer to the question would be that they are the system which is naturally a natural situation. So I got that thought and I proceeded. And I call it, this is orbit number one, Mercury. And then swung another one, and I said, orbit number two, Venus. Then another one, just a swish like that. And I said, orbit number three, Earth. And I said to myself, when I said Earth, pointed to myself in Earth. He finally did the same thing, but he stopped at orbit number two. And he pointed to himself and poked into that orbit, which means Venus. So I said Venus again. I said it about three times. So finally he said Venus just as plain as I did. And shortly after that he took off. But what I thought I have received from them, that's what I have written in the first book. Well, the odd part of it is, while we were talking, that's before we got to the ship, though, the jets appeared on the scene, two of them. And I believe that there's a script here in England right now that soon will reveal the truth of the whole situation. It'll be published in a Flying Saucer review or a book. I don't know which is going to be the case, but it's here now. That'll tell the whole story of the thing that's been kept silent all this time. So the jets were there, and the B-29 was there. And they were coming around on a couple of occasions. The wing tip was so that we thought both of our heads would come off. They finally vanished. So, when I got home, first, before getting ahead of myself, then when we were all through, and Williamson took the plastic cast, and speaking of the plastic cast, Williamson was supposed to be the anthropologist, yet his wife was the genuine one. She had a degree from the University of Arizona. But he naturally learned a lot from her, too, although he's supposed to have one. I don't know if he has or not. I never seen it. I did see his wife's degree. So he naturally knew how to do things. So he got the plaster and so forth and started taking those footprints, which he has today, the best ones. We only got what he didn't want. He never given them up. So he took those footprints and started analyzing them. And I didn't know whether they were right or not. You'll see him in a picture tonight. And so finally he asked me for one. Philip, the spaceman, took one too, as I have told you in the book. And he dropped it on December the 13th of that same year on a property where I live. Threw me back again, which is the plaque. We call it a plaque. So I give one to Williamson. And that was supposed to be a souvenir. Developed it himself, the character, or whatever developed. If there was any picture on it, no one knew whether there would be any or not. So they went to Phoenix, Arizona, went to the Phoenix Gazette, and told them what they had. Phoenix Gazette took their story, which I have, and you can purchase, where their pictures in the paper, and the whole story that they said. And in this article, it tells you plain that he tried to contact me to confirm the story, but I had no telephone, therefore I had printed it up without me knowing a thing about it. Therefore, I was really brought to the front before the public with the whole experience without even my knowledge. Then, naturally, I had to face the music in general, which I have to this day. But, again, when I came home, the FBI, the Air Force Intelligence, and others came to see me. They did not grill me at all. They didn't even ask anything at that time, what they call a grilling. They just asked me to tell them what I said to the man, what he said to me, how we understood each other. And I told them as much as I knew how, what I best understood, and they took it all down. And whatever pictures I have had, they asked me if I would give it to them. This I did. To this day, they have never yet crossed me up or thrilled me on anything so far. They always come down and ask me this and that, and I tell them. We sit down and talk very friendly in every respect. So I did that very thing. Then it was about, I think, a month or so after that. I have the little plaque right in my pocket. Desmond Leslie brought it to England when he visited me. I told him to locate this squadron that's supposed to be in England at that time. This man came from Marshfield, and he said, George, I'd like to see the plaque, the footprints, if you will let me see them. I'll even give me a picture, and I'll have them enlarged to 10 by 12 at the air base, which he did, and sent me 12 of them. So I give it to him, and give him all the material I have. He studied. He was a captain in the Air Force. And he made a little business card, which I have in my pocket. He then wrote in there quite a few things, and he stated, plain English, did you focus your telescope on me? I could not focus no telescope on anyone unless they'd be in the air. So he admitted there that he was one of the, either the jets or the B-29 in the air at the time the contact was being made. So he admitted there that he was one of the, either the jets or the B-29 in the air at the time the contact was being made. Right there, he admitted that part. So things like that have happened all the way through. So now, that much for this. So finally, of course, the second contact. When I went out on impression to the desert again, I was picked up by another person and taken to where the ship was. As I got there, I saw the man I named Barton, although that's not his name. I give him that name for the sake of the readers. I do know his symbolic name and all, which thus far nobody has yet brought through. So there he was standing, smiling, and he spoke to me for the first time in English. And I got irked a little bit because I said, here I wasted all this time on the first contact trying to convey my ideas to you and you to me. Why in the world did you speak English then, if you can speak it now? Testing him a little bit to see whether he could speak in the other language. I cannot speak very well Polish anymore, but I can say a few words, so I did. And he came back in Polish a lot better than I could. So there was no trouble at all. So then he told me why he did what he did. He said, now look, there is no telephone system between us and your planet. So the only way, if I wanted to meet you again, would be by an impression. If I could impression well enough, then you'd follow that impression, which you did in this case. And you have proven yourself well enough to be worked with. You do receive impressions fairly good. So that was the reason. We tested you to find out if we could really depend on you in case we want to see you again. At that time, he was doing something, some repair job. They must have melted up some mineral that they had to fix this job. So he dumped the rest of it on the sand. I fixed it up and takes the handkerchief and picks it up and puts it in a handkerchief. Well, he laughed at me. He said, what are you going to do with it? He said, well, I'm going to take it home because I think this is some from your own planet. That's correct. But all planets are made up of the same chemical units. So there's going to be much, not any difference. Then I said to him, but they might be better in different types of alkaline. And he smiled at that and said, so sure enough, I brought it. I tried to get it analyzed. They haven't made the analysis out of it, and they haven't given me the analysis of what they found out. That part they kept from me all the time. Until Desmond Leslie came down, and I gave him a bit of it. He went away and had it analyzed in Britain here, and gave me the analysis, saying that there are two elements in air found that were not known on Earth. And on those grounds, it became a restricted piece of material. And I couldn't publish it in my book, which was the Inside of Spaceships. Then, and in order to confirm it, I finally, luckily, run across two women in Arizona that worked for the government in a big laboratory. That's their job, good physicists and all. And I asked them if they would do it. They did. The same answer. And they even got a microwave film from it home right now. So the analysis here and the analysis in America are identical, showing that the ship is constructed of aluminum, mostly, and at the same time possessing two elements which are not known on Earth. That does not mean that we have got them, but we have not come across them. So that is the reason why I did not publish anything in a book in reference to that, because if England restricted it, America restricts it the same way. They work hand in hand that way. And I put it in the book, but you probably wouldn't have read the book, because they'd have pulled it off the market, because they didn't want it to be known, so we have to keep it that way. But that was that. Then I took the trip in the ship. Well, as I did, to tell you something about the trip. The feeling that you get first when you leave the ground is no different than the feeling that you get when you board our own aircraft. When it's starting on the runway at 125 miles per hour to get airborne, you feel that pull. Once it's airborne, don't forget our own ships. Once they are airborne, the pilot keeps us accelerating to probably 300, 350 miles per hour, and you no longer feel that acceleration. It's going right along, increasing speed you don't know anything about. The same is true with a spacecraft. It does the same thing. You don't no longer feel the acceleration once the start is made. You're already accustomed to it, and the ships are fully pressurized, same as our own aircraft are. Fully pressurized to meet the conditions of the humans they're occupied of, or working with, and so forth. So it's no different than traveling in our own ships, except that they are faster, on far greater types of instruments in them, and things like that. More comfort, and safer in many ways. A lot safer. For instance, to give you some idea on the ship now before I go into the other details, is something like this. At any risk analysis that can be made to give you an idea of what a spacecraft, a mothership, or a saucer is like when you're riding in them, it's no different than a submarine. Submarine comes the nearest of explaining the mothership. As one of our great men of the Navy has stated in America, that the submarine and the spacecraft are identical instruments in every respect. And that was an admiral of the Navy lecturing in New York. I got the lecture here. They're identical. One is made for liquid, which is water. The other one is made for gas, which is space. And both operate identically the same, except, of course, spacecraft has got more instrument probably for space purposes. It has more to encounter than a submarine has. But give you an idea on a submarine. It doesn't make no difference to the men that are inside of that submarine whether they surface the water, or go down to a depth of 300 feet in the bottom of the ocean. They don't know the difference. Their bodies are normal all the way down, when the thing is going down or when it's coming up. It does not affect them at all. They do not float around in a submarine because they come to lighter atmosphere or lighter pressure when they surface, or are they crushed when they go down to 300-foot level of the depth of the ocean. The submarine is pressurized to suit them, give them all the comforts possible that they've been enjoying on Earth outside of the submarine. The submarine is built to take care of all of that. The same thing is with a spacecraft. It's built the same way. When it's coming towards the Earth, it's no different than a ship, submarine going down toward the bottom of the ocean. The closer it gets to the bottom of the ocean, the greater pressure. The closer the spacecraft gets to it, the greater the pressure. Going up, again, is the same way. Coming up from that heavy pressure upward to surface on the water, the boys inside a submarine don't know any difference. They still are the same as they were at the bottom, and they will be at the surface. They don't float around because of the lack of gravity and things like that, like we've been taught in a submarine. Neither does a spacecraft. People in the spacecraft do, once they leave our atmosphere. They don't float around either. That's ideas that have been promoted by man's circulations as what might be, but the facts are not yet there. But that's as near as I can tell you how the ships behave, and that in reference to motherships or to saucers. Now, the people in themselves are no different than you and I. They are better looking. They look better in general, men and women alike. Why? They haven't got the tension of life that we have. They don't go through the same tension. They live longer. They live up to 1,000 years of age. Yet our own Bible tells us that one time people on this earth had lived that sort of an age. Now, of course, 1,000 years of their life on their planet would be a lot shorter, would be somewhere around 700 or 800 years of earthly type of years, because their years are shorter on Venus. I think around 260-some-odd days to an year, while ours is 365. So there is a difference there. But they do live a long life, and they look well. A person around 25 or 30 years of age in our life here. Because what causes bodies to go the way we do is the heavy tension on surfaces of life that we possess, which they have not. Their system or society has been so well organized that no one worries about tomorrow, as we do about rent and so many other things. They have a so-called a social system of a planetary unit of all humans based on one law, and that is that the planet belongs to the Creator and not to man. That man is only to be given a right to live upon it as a child of the Creator. And therefore, all children of the same family should share alike. And that's why they are living that way. And as a result, they have put all their efforts not towards accumulating money or accumulating prestige, but developing things from the mineral world to useful purposes, like different types of machines, like the space and many other things, for learning more and services unto man of that planet. In that way, the minerals actually serve man. All their daily production is all mechanical, utilizing the same power for the machinery work that operates their spacecraft from there to here and back. The same power that motivates our Earth world into action and keeps it going, which we know that our Earth is moving at 18.5 miles per second or better, yet there is no jet engine on the back of it, no wings on it, nobody pulling it, nobody pushing it. It just moves while we're living on it and don't even know that it's moving. And the spacecraft is built the same way also. The spacecraft is a copy. You might say it's a man-made planet copied after all the planets like ours and that of others, built on the same principles, complying with natural laws, and therefore natural laws lend themselves to the spacecraft to be able to travel anywhere. The only difference between a planet and a spacecraft is that a spacecraft travels wherever you want it to travel. A planet must go on its orbit like on a rail, adheres to that all the time for its control. So they have used the same power for everything that they need. Their little ships that also operate, which you in England now are beginning to realize that we're going to have here what we call an automobile without wheels, an air cushion system, they call it, and so forth in the very near future, which may be the coming year. Well, you might say that they again have something like that and have had it for a long time to go from place to place on their planets, and we don't call it air cushion system. We call it actually the electromagnetic suspension. And it's electromagnetic force, the same force that is used to propel the planets and all bodies in space, then harnessed up, producing light, producing everything. The ladies on those planets do not have to work as hard as they do. They partake equally with men in scientific and every type of research or development in the field of knowledge. And you say, we have to wash clothes. Regardless how good of machines we have, we still have to tend to those machines and wash them, clothes, in one way or another, with soap and water. They may wash them themselves once you put the clothes in there, but you still got to put the water in there. You got to still put so much soap in there and turn the switch on. They do turn the switch on, that's true, but that's all. Because it's high frequency operation, and they put the clothes into a clothes closet, so to speak, and push a button, and the clothes are clean and jiffy. Because at a high frequency, even makes them newer than they were. And they clean it that way. Everything is on high frequency, even dusting in their homes, they don't do it. Although we're now getting that same thing in America. The newer homes are being now equipped with dust accumulators and so forth, except we have not yet learned to use that dust that we accumulate, either from clothes, which we haven't got that yet, but dust that's flying around in the room we have, or the dust flying around the room that's accumulated. Because they claim that it's the finest mineral, the purest and the cleanest mineral, and they do gather it where it's supposed to gather itself in its place. They gather it like you with ashes from the stove and process it. And as a result, they don't have to do very much mining. They get better minerals that way than they would through mining processes. They do all of that. And then they have their recreations, same as you and I have. They dance, they sing, they have a grand old time. A lot better than we have because they're more relaxed. And really live for joy of living rather than for the misery of living as we do. That is the difference. We are living for the misery of it, and when the misery is about ready to be taken away from us, we start hollering. You don't want to change. You seem to like the misery. See? But that's the way we're living. Where there they do. For instance, when I asked them, I said, now look, if you come within the range of our guns and we shoot you down, and there's a tendency to killing you while we bring your ship down, would you defend yourself? with the power that you have, which is even greater than any atomic power yet hooked up. Because it's a power that's a creative power as well as a disintegrating power. It could disintegrate you in the twinkle of an eye. With that power, they want to use it, aren't you? They said, no, we couldn't. We can't take advantage of our younger brother because he doesn't understand. We'd have to die. To them, death, such as we know, is non-existent. You just destroy their house and go ahead and build another one, and better one than they do, you destroy it. So you can't beat them at all. They always got the best of you. So that way, they said, we'd have to die. Would you go there? And that kind of struck me very funny, because if we all remember well, whether we are today thinking in those terms or not, that when Christ was upon the cross, he too said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. They are actually living what we're supposed to be living instead of talking about it. And all we do is talk about it and never try to live it. Well, they are actually living. So they might say that they are a better Christian, if you want to use that word, than we are. And that is in everything. They look upon a human being, as I stated before. That's a manifestation of a creator. That's how the planet is organized. They have leaders yet. Or overseers, you might say, that see to things that are to be done. There's plenty of this for everybody, plenty of that, and plenty of everything else. So they have those overseers, which might be called like groups or states. But there is a central force that sees that all is done. And that central force can be removed by any minute if it disobeys the purpose of the planet when it starts working for itself. But that is eliminated, because why work for yourself when you've got plenty? So you see, there's nobody trying to get above the other, since they're all equal as far as the benefits of the earth are concerned to all of them alike. So there is no such a desire even as to try to get better than the other or get better arms. They are constantly improving upon themselves, either through dancing, through recreation or something. They never go up there and put up a wrestling match, let us say, only to beat the other guy. They put up a wrestling match, maybe, with the purpose of seeing how either one of them has been developed, how well they can develop from their own. In other words, make their bodies still better than what they are without injuring those bodies or in any shape or form. They will not go to the state of injury anywhere. They know how far they can go with their bodies. They know what their bodies can take. But they keep on improving upon those bodies all the time through these various exercises. They eat the same as you and I do. They eat all kinds of vegetables, a lot of fish. They do eat meat here and there. Because there is a law there that flesh is flesh and carbon is carbon. And they do keep the body going with the carbon necessary that can only come from flesh and nothing else. Because nature transmutes it in that manner. And that cannot be denied. But they do not raise animals or anything else for commercial purposes, which is the big job of ours. And they do not slaughter, if they did slaughter, in the manner as we slaughter. They do not frighten the animal or anything they might slay by the methods we do. For instance, they do something like this. They do it with a ray, of course, no bullet. But if you were walking down the street and knew that nobody was after you, that there's no one really hunting you down, you would not fear anything. You'd be very free. And all of a sudden, a bullet come along and hit you in the head and you went over, and there was not the slightest moment of you fearing anything, so you really passed away just like that, without any fear or premeditated talk of fear. So the animal goes the same way. When it does, happen. But not very often. But the idea that they're better than you and I are, they are not. They are identically the same as you and I. Let me give you some example and a way of development. The difference between our stage of development and that of theirs. So you will see that they are not to be worshipped as they have already been by some groups. And they don't want that to be done. They actually oppose it. Altogether, they dislike the idea of being worshipped or considered as master over this, although I give them a name in my book, Master. That was a mistake on my part, because I give them that name as masters, but there's no such a thing as a master anywhere, as they say. Yet I had to give some idea to convey to you the difference of their development and of mine, and I used that name, which was wrong for me to use. But, and the next book comes along, I'll have to do some explaining on it. But anyway, let us get the percentage. Not that this does not mean that they're actually that way, but just to give you an idea, just the developments or the difference between their mental stage and that of ours. Let us say that we are 10%, the scientists claim. We have developed 10% mental abilities in this world today, all of us. Well, they have developed on Mars, say 15, 5% better than we are. They have still 85% to go to make 100. On Venus, they developed 20%, so they'd have 20. Actually, 80% yet to go for improvements. We have developed 10, so we got 90 to go. That is the difference. They don't find fault with us, as you can see from the book I have written. They only show you the difference. They have not come here with the idea of converting us to their beliefs or to bring up a new religion of any kind. They are non-religious, not political, altogether. They're not concerned with races, politics, or nations. They're concerned with people. When they speak to people, they speak with to people, whether they be Negroes, whites, be communists, or Christians. They're only people. They don't recognize labels in that sense as we do. So therefore, they're concerned with people. And more so, they are concerned with the world itself. For the world is changing today, and we know it. We had the geophysical year, and it been extended for another 18 months, all because the science have found things that today are showing up where something of unpredictable at the moment could take place that might not be too pleasant for the society of the world. They're watching that. And such a publication has already come out of the findings of the first 18 months of research work on this in this field, and that is known as the Dell publication, The World in Space, 35-cent book edition, in the pocket edition. Has all the information of the first 18 months. If you can get it, and you see what's going on for yourself. Where all the top scientists and all the top military branches have been in the field of research and how these things do happen. So they're concerned with that. More than that, they're also concerned in case of a warfare, which they try to prevent as well, of atomic nature. Anybody knows that the weak faults, which we do have, like St. Andrew's fault and many others, if a given amount of concussions are placed in that particular vicinity where these faults really are, well, we wonder whether those faults could take it or not. That concussion of atomic nature, 1,000 bombs a day or more, the chances are they might open up. And if they open up wider than they are, there's also a chance that the world would split in half and go to pieces. We probably wouldn't know a thing about it by that time. But it would go to pieces. But that would affect the system. Since all of this system are balanced by the planets and the positions the planets hold in those systems, they are balanced. Not one out, and although its whole system out of balance, no different than if it took a lug out of a front wheel or a back wheel of your car that's put on there to balance up those wheels. But throw the car out of balance and you'd have a rough ride. The same thing with this. So they are observing it from that angle. Purely scientific intervention, you might say. Yet, and also preventing us from going all out in the war of that nature, which would affect them. But aside from that, they don't care what you believe and what you don't believe. They're not here to impose upon your mind any new ideas of religion. If you think that there is are better than what we got, then it's up to you to have it, to take it. And you don't have to pay for it. The knowledge is free. And the only reason why the book has been written, take my, for instance, inside the spaceship the way it has, because it was no different than I come to England. I come to England, I don't know its laws, so I ask you. You tell me what I can do, what I can't do. You have never been in America, maybe, so you ask me, how is America in this matter? We exchange information of each nation. And that's what they've done to me, and that's why I've written about it when it comes to that book idea. Just what they told me, all because I've asked them for it. People ask me and I ask them, and they give me the information, I have written it up. Yet very little of it is in that book. There's much more that I have that cannot be written up at this time. But future day may bring it all out, providing the humanity is already ready for such an information. You must be hungry before you will eat or fed. And so far the public has not been too hungry for anything greater than the books that are already out. Again, as far as having children is concerned and so forth, yes, they have children same as we have. The same thing, except not in the large numbers that we have. That's true. They know how to control the laws. In other words, they're not subject unto natural laws. They utilize the natural laws and the natural laws serve them. The natural laws are known as the divine laws. Because all laws of nature have been promoted, brought into act by the Creator and not by man. That's why Christ said so well. That the natural man knows the way of the Spirit, while the unnatural man knows not the way of the Spirit. Since we don't know the way of the Spirit today, only evidence that we have gotten away from nature far enough that we no longer are as natural as we should be. And they are. And that is one reason that we call it divine laws, that which is really natural law. It is divine because it's promoted by or set forth in action, an operation by a divine hand. But we call divine hand, the supreme being of the cosmos. And they recognize all of that. So they have learned to control. And if you read even our own book, which it should not be a mystery, that they do that. Because we were given the right to do the same thing. A man should learn himself first. And when he does, he will learn also that he can. He was given the right, that's his birthright, given the right to have all minerals, fowl and air, water and all, serve him instead of him being a slave unto him, them, which we serve. And when he does, he will learn also that he can. He was given the right, that's his birthright, given the right to have all minerals, fowl and air, water and all, serve him instead of him being a slave unto him, them, which we today are. So they have learned that. So you see, what we should have learned, we have not. They have, but their people no different than you and I. They do not have sickness, they have no diseases, they have no pain of any kind. Therefore, when your body is in normal state, up to par, it can reject anything that might encroach itself upon you and cause you a suffering or diseases. Well, they have no such a thing because their bodies are up to par in every respect, operating perfectly under a law that never is disturbed. And so they have no sickness. As far as that, as I said, yes, they have that process. And the reason why all of us cannot go to the planet of one kind or another, just as we are, few people can be taken, and they have been, to show that a man can live in another planet, though he accustomed and been born here to live. But all of them could not do that, because the earth lends you itself, the minerals of which your and my body is made. So if everybody was to be transported immediately, and then another group going to fill in the gap, and suddenly finding a few years, say 100 years or more, pretty soon they'd be no worse. We transported the dirt of Earth through flesh and blood into another planet, made it again, and annihilated this one. So what each planet has that belongs to it must be left behind. And they know that. That's why death is not death to them. They just graduate from one classroom to another, and that classroom, the next classroom, will have the goods or the necessary things for them, which they must use or have. That's their actual belief in that matter. So, I don't know how much more I can talk to you about these things. There's so much that you sometimes don't know just exactly where to start or where to finish. But they do not have any religion as we have in the same sense that we go to church on Sunday and cut the throat of a fellow being on a Monday. They do not have that. Their church is everyday living. They employ the law or exercise the law which Christ taught us. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Very simple law. They recognize the other as a divine manifestation of a divine power as they themselves are. To hurt that form would be hurting that which works through that form, which is the divine law. They know that. That's just the same thing. You may be admiring a house, a dwelling place of someone, but you might, if you knew the man, the occupant of the house, admire him far more for the intelligence that that house expresses, for he was the builder of it. And that's what they do in every form. Now, because everybody is not up to par in their intelligence or mental expression, they have just as much of a need for a pick and shovel man, let us say, as they have for an artist that would picture a beautiful picture on a wall, a mural. For if it wasn't for that pick and shovel man digging up the minerals necessary to make that paint or the colors out of it, the artist would never express his talent. So he's honored equally as the artist itself is. In other words, they recognize all phases of mental developments that fit into the plan of society which makes the whole planet live as a unit together and progressing together. Everyone does something different. Then they too, being the mentalists, they do not exhaust very much energy in talking to each other. They pass the thoughts lengthy onto one another, and they recognize themselves. And if you go back in your own thought, you will find that if you had a way of passing a picture of your mind onto another, you could convey your idea a lot better than the words that you're trying to use to convey the idea to. So they use that. In their singing and so forth, they use sound. Otherwise, they don't. Then also, they also get a lot of information for the improvement of the planet from children that are just born. Child that's just born, many times you have seen it, while in the cradle, it smiles. It almost wants to talk to you. It isn't smiling out at you at all. And it's not wanting to talk to you in the sense that you think it does. But if something is passing through that purity of that mind, because that mind is so pure, as a negative has not been impressed upon of the world, with anything of the world's nature, that's pure in its state. And something is passing there, and that negative began to express itself in a happy form. They are able to read that. Should they see something or some new revelations coming through that pure mind of that little babe laying in a cradle, they'll accept it and incorporate it into their society immediately as a betterment of their society. While we make fun of the little child or get a laugh ourselves because the child is trying to say something or trying to smile to us. We don't know the reason why he thinks he's trying to please us. He's not trying to please us at all. But he's expressing thoughts that if you could get it, it would be a great help. And I think, again, that also comes to this point, that we might say, let the child even, in this pure state of mind, and let the other minds follow and become as pure as it is. Now, coming to the conclusion, I want to tell you about the flying saucers, and things have progress just for a few moments. And that's all. And then we go on with the other. Here we have a document. I'm going to read it, a small portion of it. And everybody been saying, how come that no government have actually officially announced the flying saucers to be a reality, or that they exist at all? Yet we know that the Brazilian government 2 years ago have made such a statement, brought out such a picture, which tonight we'll see in the movies, is incorporated there. But here's one that's last year's by the President of the United States of America. Eisenhower, in Congress in recent months, took the most decisive and substantially important steps to give solid significance and great prestige to a space exploration and the study, get this one, and the study of craft from space. You know yourself that you cannot study a craft from space unless it's coming from space to here. Furthermore, you cannot study craft from space when it's in the air unless it lands. Then you can make a good study of it. Go through it and study it very well. But here it is. I'll repeat it again. Exploration of and study of craft from space in all problems of air phenomena. So you have official acknowledgement of them here. This bill became a law, actually passed. And if you want the number of the bill to write for, you have a right to have it. H.R. 85568. It passed and signed by the President of the United States, incorporating in that sense this particular statement on all that goes with it as a bill in July the 29th of 1958. So America has officially announced them to be official. You can't get any more. Now, any more that you might want cannot be brought up at this time under any condition until the people themselves settle down and be ready for more. There is a lot more to it, naturally. But the great body of men have been appointed to handle the situation. This is not now known, as you will be reading as time goes on. Your own nation made the announcement here just a few days ago that it's entered the space race. Frankly speaking, there are 87 nations that have been incorporated in that particular setup that I just mentioned. 87 nations. Your nation made a statement here that has recently entered the space race. Naturally. Well, the space race is known by the letters MASA. It's the same group of men which are civilians, connected with the government, also with the military to some degree, but mostly civilian setup. Known as the MASA, that shut this last shot out, that joined the Sputnik of the Russians that is circling the sun, known as a moonshot. It's this group that did it. And this group actually is going to do a lot more. To give you a little idea on that, and I hope that it's not taken politically, as somebody says it might be political, what does the bill mean? Just the short, I'll give you. The bill means that you and I will live instead of having atomic bomb tear us to pieces. Nihilators. Because we have and are, at the moment, on war economy, as you know. Changing over to the space economy, a space will demand a lot more instruments than we have for war purposes, a lot more exploration, a lot more ships of various types as we learn what is needed, and the employment that could be otherwise non-employment will be full and maybe more people employed than they are even now. There may be a greater demand for labor, for all sorts of mechanics, science of every type, as we venture into outer space. We today in America are already building a spacecraft. You are too. If you knew the truth, we are building it and we're not making any bones about it. And I have an article right here that the contract been let last November. Right here I have it. It's been published, so it's nothing new. It's this one here. We asked for bids. And the man that asked for these bids of a spacecraft is the same man that you've been reading in reference to the NASA program that shot out the moonshot. Same man. Where he asked all the aircraft and missile manufacturers to give a bid to the United States government for a spacecraft that'll go out there and come back, bring people back. We also are already training 50 men and women, young people. I say young because it's from 20 to 40 years of age, which the government asks for volunteers, and we are training them for this particular trip. They'll be going to Venus, directly to Venus. And a sociology is one of the things they must learn. Now, there's no human beings on that planet, why sociology? And yet, that's one of the things they must learn. That was all already published in your papers. So you see, we are actually venturing out into outer space only because the flying saucers have come on the scene. We have talked about flying saucers, about going in outer space a long time. But never in our time had we actually taken a step forward to go into outer space. But when the flying saucer appeared on the scene where it became a public knowledge throughout the world, we naturally thought, well, whether these human beings look like us or not, the admission is one thing. That these things that fly through space are controlled intelligently. They produce intelligent maneuvers that only intelligence could produce. So whatever the type of human being is, the intelligence in there are capable of moving through space. And if they can, we can. So then we started out. And so you might say that the flying saucer really was the one that gave us a kick to finally go out of space and start to talk about it. Just the same as America was finally made to speed up a program when the Russians shot their Sputnik out and woke us up. And we finally woke up and started moving in that direction to beat them now, what little jump they did have on us. Same thing. So you see, the saucers have actually, as they are called, done tremendous lot of good to the society already, telling us that we can't live providing we go out of space. Because if we continue in the war effort, we eventually must have a war. We cannot go on that way and not have a war. But if we can swing the whole program over, and most wars are based on economics, we'll finally swing to where we live, have prosperity probably for thousands of years, no more wars on Earth, because we'll be so busy in outer space research. And the things we learn, the more we learn, the less we'll be thinking about wars of any kind. And so, that much the flying saucers have already done for all of us. Thank you.